shorthand approach, we fill in the blanks with interviews, commentary, discussion, to give the news a clarity and depth that we feel is unique on radio. Join me weekdays for NPR's Morning Edition.
From 6 until 8:29 a.m. on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
It's 2 minutes after 3 o'clock. Good afternoon. My name's Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
It's so easy to fall in love. It's so easy to fall in love. People tell me love's for fools. So here I go, breaking all of the rules. It seems so easy.
Seems so easy, seems so easy.
Oh, so doggone easy.
Doggone easy, doggone easy.
It seems so easy.
Seems so easy, seems so easy, seems so easy.
Well, you're concerned, my heart has learned. It's so easy to fall in love. It's so easy to fall in love. Set apart for me, it seems so easy.
Seems so easy, seems so easy.
Oh, so doggone easy.
Doggone easy, doggone easy. Mm-hmm.
It seems so easy.
Seems so easy, seems so easy, seems so easy.
Where you're concerned, my heart has turned. It's so easy to fall in love. It's so easy to fall in love.
Doggone easy, doggone easy, doggone easy.
It seems so easy.
Seems so easy, seems so easy, seems so easy.
Well, where you concern, my heart has turned. It's so easy to fall in love. It's so easy to fall in love.
Buddy Holly opening up today's Fresh Air with his recording of It's So Easy. And the director of the film The Buddy Holly Story, Steve Rash, will be with us in just a minute on Fresh Air. This afternoon on Fresh Air at about 4:45, we'll have some Valentine's Day advice to the lovelorn from Village Voice columnist Cynthia Heimel, author of the book Sex Tips for Girls. In 1962, during an affluent period for America, Michael Harrington wrote the book The Other America, a study of poverty, that reminded the middle class and American political leaders that many Americans were excluded from the prosperity. Michael Harrington has been one of the leaders of the American left for a couple of decades. He's currently the national co-chair of the Democratic Socialists of America. When he joins us at about 3:30, we'll discuss the subject of his new book, The Politics at God's Funeral, The Spiritual Crisis of Western Civilization. Buddy Holly, one of the first rock and roll stars, was killed in a plane crash in early February, 25 years ago. Holly was the subject of a critically acclaimed feature film directed by my guest Steve Rash. The Buddy Holly Story starred Gary Busey as Buddy Holly. Rash also directed Under the Rainbow, a feature film which starred Chevy Chase and Carrie Fisher and was about the auditions of dwarves to play the roles of munchkins in The Wizard of Oz. My guest Steve Rash recently returned to his home in Bucks County after living in Los Angeles for several years. Welcome back to Fresh Air, Steve.
Hi.
Rash.
It's nice to be here.
Let's talk a little bit about Buddy Holly before we talk about other aspects of your film career. Was Buddy Holly an important figure to you musically?
Well, he grew to be. When I was a kid growing up in Texas, I was mainly interested in classical music and jazz, and had no interest at all in rock and roll except for parties. You know, it was music to dance to. And one day I heard on the radio a record that had strings in it, which attracted me, and it was a beautiful melody, and it stuck. And I couldn't get that song out of my head. It was the first time a rock and roll song did that to me. And I actually went down to the store and bought the record. It was the very first 45 I bought, and it was Buddy Holly's True Love Ways. And still to this day, 25 years, well, actually almost 30 years later, it's still my favorite song.
You grew up in Texas.
Yeah.
And I think Buddy Holly was Well, much more popular in Texas than he was in the northern cities.
Yeah, he was more popular in the South, the Southwest, and the West. His popularity in the East never really developed until after his death. And actually, he was the biggest star in Europe, in England. In fact, at the time he died, he was a bigger star than Elvis Presley.
We're going to compare some records of his in a minute, but do you want to say a few words about Buddy Holly as a musical figure, what you think his importance was?
Well, he invented a lot of things that we take for granted today. He invented the rock and roll combo. Before Buddy, there were guys like Elvis Presley who were singing in front of groups like the Jordanaires, and they had pickup orchestras that they'd pick up locally to play the charts. And Buddy had this idea of a self-contained sound. And that's really his contribution to rock and roll, is that Buddy Holly was the first guy that had a sound in his head, somewhat like Glenn Miller had a sound in his head. It took Glenn Miller years to find out how to get that sound. It took Buddy a very short time, and he fought very hard with the recording industry of his day to get that sound that he had in his head. And when he finally got it, the world took note.
Let's compare a couple of the recordings that he did of one of his own songs, and we're going to hear That'll Be the Day. Two different Buddy Holly recordings. Tell us about each.
Well, one of Buddy's early recording sessions was in Nashville. Decca Records wanted to record Buddy Holly because they had seen him perform in and around Lubbock. When he got to the Decca recording studios, they wouldn't let him use his group. They made him use their backup musicians, their backup singers. They changed the key that he was singing in. They made the pitch way up above Buddy's range. They changed the rhythm. They changed the emphasis on the beat. It was just totally different song than Buddy had written. But, you know, being a nice little kid from Texas, he bowed to their pressure and he recorded it their way.
And then he made his own recording of it?
And then that record was a flop. And then he went back to Lubbock. Actually went to Clovis, New Mexico, where a man had a small recording studio and would let Buddy do it his way, and then he recorded it the way he wanted it.
Okay, well, let's hear both versions. We'll hear the Nashville version first, which means that we'll reverse the original order that I mentioned to our engineer. Okay, let's hear the two versions of That'll Be the Day. Two versions of Buddy Holly singing That'll Be the Day, the first recorded in Nashville, not exactly the way he wanted to do it, and the second recorded, and was that produced by Norm Petty?
Yeah.
Was he happy with the Norm Petty production, do you think?
I think so. Later on, he became unhappy with the business dealings with Norman Petty, but I think Norman was good for... Norman was to Buddy Holly much like George... what's his name?
Martin.
George Martin was for the Beatles. Norman had the musical background to execute some of Buddy's ideas, but he listened to Buddy, much like George listened to Paul and John, and helped them get what they wanted. Whereas in Nashville, the producer, you know, had his own ideas and he was going to do it his way, and the kid was just a little fodder.
I've heard all kinds of stories about how the Crickets were added on after the fact or manufactured more by the producer than by Buddy Holly. What's the story about the Crickets that we hear on the recordings?
The true story about the name of the Crickets is there was a cricket in the echo chamber in the studio in Closed, New Mexico, that got on the end of a couple of records, and they chose the name the Crickets sort of as a lark. Buddy and Jerry Allison and Joe Malden and Nicky Sullivan played together quite a lot at various times in their high school days and immediately after graduation. Norman did not create the Crickets. Norman was the external force that came in after the Crickets were really together.
I guess I'm thinking of the vocal backup. Did the musicians do that, or was that added on afterwards?
Most of the time it was done partly at the time and partly afterward. Now, some of Buddy's material that he recorded demo tapes at home or in his garage or in various places, that after his death, Norman Petty then came in and brought singers and other instruments in and laid on top of it and, in some people's opinion, trashed them up a lot. But the records like That'll Be the Day and the other ones that were released while Buddy was alive, they were all pretty much recorded on the spot.
The Buddy Holly was a great influence on the Beatles, and you were telling me that you spent a weekend with Paul McCartney right before the European release of your movie, The Buddy Holly Story.
Yeah.
Did you talk with him at all about Holly?
Yeah. Paul has been a Buddy Holly freak since he was a kid. He latched onto Buddy Holly's sound or something about Buddy's innovative choice of chords instead of the standard blues chords that most of the other rock and rollers were doing. Buddy was not afraid to introduce other progressions and to take ideas from other sources, jazz and standard show tunes, classical licks. He was totally open to musical form. And I think that's one of the big influences on Paul's ability to choose symphonic changes and what I call, at the time, outrageous changes, such as Michelle. For a rock and roll performer to come up with the changes of Michelle was really audacious, but he did it, and he made it work. And I think Buddy was a big influence on Paul's attitude toward music and changes.
We have two versions of another Buddy Holly song, and that's Words of Love, and we'll hear Buddy Holly doing it first and then the Beatles version of it afterwards. Do you want to say anything about the two before we listen?
No, you should. I think you should compare... the respect that the Beatles gave to Buddy's arrangement of Words of Love.
Let's hear it.
Hold me close and tell me how you feel. Tell me love is real. Words of love you whisper soft and true. Darling, I love you. And tell me how you feel.
tell me love is real. Words of love you whisper soft and true. Darling, I love you.
There's a lot of similarity between the mm-hmm. Beatles version and the Buddy Holly version. You were telling me that the Buddy Holly recording was the first example of multi-tracking.
Yeah, it was an idea that Buddy got from, I think probably Les Paul and Mary Ford were the first people to do that, re-record their own voice, overdub their own voice, multi-track it. And Buddy took that idea and was the first, to my knowledge, to apply that to rock and roll. And he sang harmony with himself on that record. And I suspect that's one of the reasons the Beatles liked it so much, is they immediately could hear that was Buddy singing twice, and I'm sure it gave them the idea to do their own multitracking, which they were experts at.
Our listeners who saw your movie, The Buddy Holly Story, who've also seen Gary Busey in other roles, will know how he completely transformed himself to fit the role of Buddy Holly. It was really quite remarkable. Yeah. Can you describe what he did for that role physically as well as, you know, other forms of preparation?
Well, physically, he lost... he went from 215 pounds from Straight Time, which was the film he did with Dustin Hoffman, to 165 pounds. Now, he went through another film called Big Wednesday, where he played a surfer on the way to Buddy Holly. And the physical conditioning that he did for the surfing movie was a good start. He weighed about 185 when he did Big Wednesday, and then he dropped another 20 pounds to do Buddy Holly. But in the space of a little over a year, he went from 215 to 165 pounds.
How did you know during the auditions that he was going to be good?
Well, I saw Gary in a movie, a pilot for a series called The Law. It eventually became Petrocelli, but the premiere episode was called The Law, and Gary played a rather small role in that movie and just blew me away. I just thought he was the most real person I'd seen on the screen in years. And I found out when it came time to cast Buddy Holly, after we had rejected all of the studio's desires to put David Cassidy or someone like that in the role, found out that Gary was a rock and roll drummer, had played with Leon Russell. And as soon as I found out that this actor, who I had been so impressed with, also knew what it was like to be on stage and to gig in front of people, I knew there had to be a possibility there. Found out later on, Gary had been cast in another film that was about the Buddy Holly and the Crickets, a 20th Century Fox film, and Gary had been cast as the drummer. And it had been a terrible experience for him. The film was closed down. It was really a painful experience for Gary. And he didn't want to audition for our movie because he didn't want to have anything to do with Buddy Holly again. But the casting director convinced him to come in and meet with us. And he did, and we hit it off, and the rest is history.
Who else did they want besides who is it that you just mentioned?
David Cassidy.
David Cassidy, yeah.
Bobby
Sherman. Other unlikely people?
I can't remember now because a lot of them were the stars that come and go weekly. You know,
that's right. Yeah.
In the teen magazines, but the studios we tried to sell the idea of that movie for 3 years, and the studios were all for it. But they, as long as we'd cast it with a star, you know, and I knew that the film wouldn't work with a star. You had to see somebody up there that you believed as Buddy Holly, or it wouldn't work.
The film won an Academy Award for the musical score, mm-hmm. and was really critically acclaimed. Mm-hmm. It was not a major commercial success in the way that blockbuster movies
are. No, it was not a blockbuster. It made money.
But it must have made money,
yeah,
because
it wasn't
a very expensive movie like the blockbusters tend to be.
Very cheap movie.
Was it considered a real success by Los Angeles industry standards?
Well, yeah, because it was a sleeper. In Hollywood, there's nothing better than to have a film that nobody knows anything about, and when it comes time for screenings, you know, all the people that are so-called in the business say, oh, I saw this terrific little film. It's a real sleeper. It's going to be a smash, you know, which is almost like reverse word of mouth. You know, so it worked very much to our advantage in the fact that the film was totally coming from nowhere. And so, yeah, it was artistically, it was quite well received. You know, it was nominated for 3 Academy Awards, Gary among them, for Best Actor. And I don't think to this day the people in Hollywood realize that one of the reasons of that movie's success with the audience was that it was recorded live. They're still lip-syncing or overdubbing or multiple-tracking or looping or whatever you want to call it, but they haven't learned that when someone's actually singing in front of a camera, there's a difference. It may be subconscious, but there's a big difference to the performer, if not to the audience. And that had a lot to do with the success of that movie, as you really believed that man was singing because he was.
My guest is Steve Rash, who directed the film The Buddy Holly Story and also the film Under the Rainbow, and he now lives in Bucks County. After the success of the Buddy Holly Story, were you sent a lot of other scripts?
Yeah, every person who had died in the last 20 years that had ever played a guitar or seen one, I was offered to do their story. Otis Redding, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, Elvis Presley, and on and on and on. Because, you know, that was a hot movie.
Why did you reject, as you did, the offers to direct other film biographies about late dead performers?
Quite frankly, I don't think I could do as good a job as another director who's approaching the subject fresh. I think all during the course of the production, I would be thinking to myself, oh, I've done this. Even if I hadn't done that precise thing, I would think that I had, and I think it would take some of the edge off of it.
The film that you did direct was Under the Rainbow. Mm-hmm. Why did you choose that one? What appealed to you?
Well, it was not about a dead rock and roller. That had a lot to do with it. It was a comedy. It was a terrific idea. I went to a couple of the conventions of the Little People of America, and I got to know some of the little people, and I became absolutely fascinated and enthralled with the experience that the little people have, and I really wanted to work with them.
Can you explain the premise of the movie for listeners who haven't seen it?
It's the basic premise of the movie was when they were getting ready to make The Wizard of Oz in 1938, they needed a couple of hundred people to play the Munchkins. They needed small people, and they originally were going to use children. But that same year, the Jackie Coogan Law was passed, prohibiting the use of children in motion pictures except with very strict and rigid working hours and so forth. So they went on. In fact, they postponed the movie and caused a conflict with Gone with the Wind. The same director directed both of those films. But they went out on a crash program to find little people, dwarfs, midgets, whatever you want to call them. And they recruited 125 midgets, as they were known in those days, to come to Hollywood from all over the world to play the Munchkins. And in 1938, if you were a little person, chances are you may have seen one or two other ones in your whole life. And all of a sudden, there were 125 of them together, and it just caused this swelling confidence and personal pride and realization that I'm not alone in the world. There are others like me, and I'm a real person. And they wrecked the hotel because they just went nuts as far as it was like being released from a prison, a mental prison. And the stories, many of them lies, have been circulating in Hollywood ever since. And it just seemed like a wonderful premise.
What are some of the stories that you learned about that network of short people from directing the movie?
Well, from the days of The Wizard of Oz, they have stayed in contact. They have formed organizations to help each other live in a difficult world. And the LPA, the Little People of America, has, I think, close to 6,000 members now across the country. They have seminars and conventions where they will bring in orthopedic surgeons and clothing manufacturers and shoe manufacturers and you know, all kinds of things that they need special care or treatment, and they get bulk rates, basically. And then there's a lot of research going on into dwarfism, which they are promoting.
How much creative freedom did you have in that role, in directing that film, since it was your second film, and you were probably deeper into the industry at that point?
You know, it's hard to answer. Creative freedom is really a myth. By the time you get to the stage, things are so set in stone, you don't have that much ability to change things anyway. You can have all the freedom in the world, but if the ideas have not been pre-executed, if all of the components are not there, it doesn't matter how good your idea is. Creative freedom is, I think, is a myth. The creative freedom occurs before you ever get to the point of shooting the movie. In other words, it's in the pre-production is where, if you have any freedom, that's where you have to exercise it, because once you get the ball rolling, it has an inertia of its own.
Did the film turn out to be the way you imagined it would?
No, not really. There were a lot of problems. The day that we were scheduled to start, the actors went on strike for 9 weeks. Oh. We were $4 million over budget before we ever rolled a camera. It was not a happy experience. Carrie got sick. A whole raft of problems developed over that film that took a lot of the fun out of it.
What were you offered scripts about midgets?
No. As a matter of fact, not a one.
I guess that's probably because nobody's making them.
I guess so.
You recently moved back to Bucks County about a year ago after living in Los Angeles for several years. Why did you want to move back to Bucks County? Because you had left that area to move to Los Angeles.
Well, Hollywood is a fun place to be, but it's no place to live because it's a totally created and manufactured environment. It has nothing to do with Mother Earth. You never see any vestige of reality. All you see is concrete and steel and glass and automobiles and, you know, flashing lights and fun and games. It's not a real place to be. After the third year, I really missed rain and I missed leaves falling and, you know, all of the things that keep us in contact with our environment are not there, and I began to feel very lost, and I missed the world, and I think this area is the real world, and that area out there is not. That's playtime.
Can you operate from Bucks County as a home base?
I hope
and
so.
Still stay in touch with all the people you need to?
Well, the way I figure it, this is a cheap place to live. I know the listeners may not believe that, but real estate prices, food prices, are a lot lower here than they are in most of the flashier parts of the country, the Southwest or the West. And so I don't have to make as much money to live a decent life here. And so if I don't have to make as much money, then I don't have to work as much, and I don't have to be away from my family as much. So, you know, to me, that makes it worth less quote-unquote success. And also, I'm tired of L.A. on film. You know, all these television shows are the same street corners and the same buildings, and I'm just so sick of seeing them. I want to photograph Philadelphia. This is one of the most interesting places in the world. And Philadelphia has never been really photographed. And I think I have two projects under development now, both of which would be shot in the Philadelphia area. And I hope very much that I can get one or both of them done, because there's so much to see here. The world has never seen the East Coast because in the days when the film industry first developed in New York, they didn't have the ability to go outside. They were all the movies were shot in sound stages. And now that you can go outside and shoot the real world, I don't think the film industry has done a very good job of showing off the United States of America. They just show you Hollywood, and that's not America.
It would be exciting to have a film shot in Philadelphia. I always especially enjoy seeing footage of this area.
I'd love to see it on the screen.
Mm-hmm. You got your start in media doing television dance shows, yeah. and something that sounds like it was really the predecessor of rock videos.
Yeah, some other people from Philadelphia, Bob Whitney and Freddie Bauer, joined me in Atlanta to do what we called a continuous flow music programming, which I guess is pretty close to what MTV is. It was we were only on the air on the weekends, but we were on the air virtually around the clock on the weekends. We had a disc jockey, a video jockey, telejockey we called him. We did film pieces and dance pieces and much the same type of visual concept treatment of songs that they're doing on MTV today. And in fact, it was on the air, a version of that, a syndicated version of that called The Music Connection was on the air here in Philadelphia for a couple of seasons.
What do you think of the latest music videos?
Well, I think Thriller's wonderful. I've seen a couple of others that I think are pretty good. Basically, though, I'm bored by it, partly because I've done it for so long, but also I don't think the music is all that great. Most, you know, there's not that much good music around today. We're sort of in a slow period, I think, in popular music. And so if the music is not all that great, then it doesn't matter what the visuals are. It's still not all that great.
Are there any other projects that you could tell us about? I always expect people to not talk about projects in progress, but if there's anything else that you could let us know about.
Well, there's a couple of projects that might work out for Philadelphia. One is set in Kensington, and the other one is set in Bucks County. And one of them is a story about a young boy who wants to be a tap dancer in an age when there are no tap dancers. And the other one is sort of almost a metaphysical horror story that has quite an unusual ending.
Wow. Well, they both sound great. I hope they're made so I can see them.
Me too.
And I want to thank you very much for coming to Fresh Air and talking
about
this.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a good time.
Steve Resch has been my guest, and he's a film director whose movies are The Buddy Holly Story and Under the Rainbow. And we're going to hear another selection, but this time from the soundtrack of the film, The Buddy Holly Story. And Joe Renzetti, who also lives now in Bucks County, did the scoring for the film and won an Academy Award for it. Steve Resch lives in Bucks County. And this is Gary Busey from the film, The Buddy Holly Story, singing Buddy Holly's Rave On.
Are you ready? I didn't hear you. I said, are you ready? All right. Let's have a nice round of applause for Mr. Buddy Holly and the Cricket.
Oh, well, a little place that you say and do make me want folks to be with you. Rave on is a crazy feeling, and I know it's got me reeling when you say you love me, just rave on.
It's so easy to fall in love.
That was Gary Busey from the film The Buddy Holly Story, which was directed by Steve Rash, who now lives in Bucks County. It's 22 minutes to 4 o'clock. This is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY 91 FM. With me now on Fresh Air is Michael Harrington, who's been a leader of the American left for about three decades. He was the associate editor of The Catholic Worker, a socialist Catholic newspaper, in the 1950s. In 1960, he helped organize civil rights demonstrations at the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles. In 1965, he joined Martin Luther King Jr.'s advisory committee. Michael Harrington has also been active in the American labor movement and was active against the war in Vietnam. Through the 60s and 70s, he campaigned for presidential candidates Eugene McCarthy, Robert Kennedy.